one, two, three. Start. I'll just do a brief audio check, make sure everybody's picking up the sound properly. And today we'll be discussing Bilaam and the Talking Donkey. This is past week's Parsha of Balak. All right, JHS, thanks for the confirmation on the audio. And if everybody else can just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen, that'll let us know that you're picking up the audio properly. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good, Doug.
Good.
How are you doing?
Josh,
tonight?
You still there? Yeah. Morning,
good.
Good
morning,
Rabbi.
Good morning, Cal. Good morning, Josh. How are you?
Hey.
Second. Okay, so I decided that we'll do today, we'll take up, I don't think we did in the past, you correct me if I'm wrong, but the whole story that we read yesterday in Shul about Bilaam and the talking donkey, what the whole conversation was, is it literal, how do we understand it? So many details in the story too, and so much that the rabbis wrote about it, and even that the literal words of the rabbis themselves are very cryptic. So let's see. As the story you know is that Balak was the king of Moab at that time, and he saw the Jews had conquered a couple of nations, and they were now approaching his border, and he was concerned very much about such a large number of people that they outnumbered him. So he sends messengers to Bilaam. Bilaam had this reputation of being able to curse and bless. And of course, if you read Rabbi Chait's article on that, you know, a human being has no ability to change laws of nature. I mean, again, a human being, we actually discussed this at the Noachide conference, that somebody had a question whether people had any powers, and the principle is that since people came onto earth after natural laws were already created, so that means everything which controls natural law is in existence before man gets here. So that means it's out of his control. So that simple principle tells us that man has no ability to make changes, certainly by just words. Okay. How's the sound, by the way? Everything's good? Okay. All right. So what was the whole concept? Why did Balak believe? Why did Balak believe that he could? That Bilaam had the power to curse and so on. There must have been something which Bilaam did to set himself apart from other people. So as Rabbi Chait explained, that Bilaam had good insight into when people were rising and falling, and he would be able to see at the commencement of their fall or at the commencement of their rise. The factors, and he knew what was going to happen just based on natural law. So he would enunciate a curse or a blessing, and it would appear to the onlooker as if Bilaam caused it. Really, he was no different than a meteorologist who sees the factors and tells you today that it's going to rain. So the meteorologist could have done like Bilam and said that I'm now casting a spell on the skies and I'm going to make it rain today and make it sunny tomorrow. And then certainly when it happens, it appears that he's causing it. But that's to the ignorant person. So that's what happened with Bilam. Bilam had this ability to do this. He capitalized on the people's ignorance and their fears, and he made it look as if he had that ability.
So he wouldn't be any different than someone who was trying to forecast financial market moves.
That's right, no different. No, there's no power. Again, all laws that govern the universe were in existence before man came here. So that means something else gave those laws their abilities and their scope and their range of operation. It's like if a baby was able to talk, as soon as it's born, it says, I'm responsible for building the Empire State Building. I mean, it's ridiculous. It was here before you were here. Okay, so now what happens is that Bilam is a wicked person. He wants to curse the Jews. So he goes with the second set of messengers, and this is what happens. So he gets up,
Rabbi?
Yes.
So when you just said Bilam is a wicked person and he wants to curse the Jews, is it clear to us why he wants to do that? I mean, is it just because he thinks there's monetary value in it, or is there something else going on there?
I'm not sure. It's a good question. I'm not sure what his motivation was. It would seem the safe thing is to say the minimum, as always. And that is that he was doing it as a response to the prospect of money and power.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. So Bilam gets up the next day. He saddles his donkey, and he goes with the officers of that Balak, the king of Moab, had sent. And it says that God was very angry that he went. So it says that God stood a angel of God in the way to divert him. And Bilam was riding on his donkey, and his two lads were with him. Interesting detail. So the donkey saw this angel of God standing in the way, and its sword was outstretched in its hand, and the donkey turned aside from the way, and it went into the field. So Bilam hit the donkey to get it back on the path. Then the angel of God stood in the vineyard, and there was a fence on both sides of him this time. And the donkey saw the angel of God again, and now it crushed against the wall, I guess, to avoid it. And then it crushed Bilam's leg as it was doing that. And Bilam continued to hit it. And the angel of God continued to pass over, and it stood in a place that was narrow. There was no ability now for the donkey to turn right or left. And the donkey saw this angel of God a third time, and it crouched down under Bilam, and now Bilam's anger flared, and he hit the donkey with a stick. Now all of a sudden it tells us the object that is, with which he's hitting the donkey. So then it says that God opened up the mouth of the donkey, and it spoke to Bilam. And it says, what are you doing? You're hitting me these three times. Interesting, it makes a note of three times. V'yomer Bilam l'asun, and Bilam says back to this donkey, if you have mocked me, had there been a sword in my hand, I would kill you. And the donkey says back to Bilam, am I not the donkey that you rode upon from days from old? Till this day? Is it my way to do this? So Bilam says no. And then at that point, God opened up Bilam's eyes and he saw the angel of God. So clearly he did not see the angel of God until this point where the donkey had. And he saw it standing in the way, and its sword was outstretched in his hand. And it said to the angel of God, said to Bilam, why have you hit your donkey these three times? Again, three times is mentioned. Behold, I have come out to turn you aside, because your way is contrary to mine. is what the angel is saying to Bilam. And your donkey saw me, and it turned from aside these three times. All right, this is the fourth time it says three times. Had it been that you turned aside, I would even kill you, and the donkey I would have let live. Okay. All right. The story continues, and he says, "If my way is against you, I'll go back." And the Malach says back to the king's, angel's back says back to Bilam, "No, go with the man that you are with. Go with the man that you are with. However, the word that I speak, that is all you should say." So he goes. Okay. So now we have this story, and what is odd? If we had to like line up the questions, what would you say the primary questions, and what I guess more peripheral? But what strikes you as the questions?
Well, I would wonder what the whole purpose of this is anyway, that, you know, you're sitting on a donkey and it sees the angel, but you can't see the angel. I mean, what does that mean? And why then, after a short little oral dialogue, now Bilam can see the angel? Like, well, if there's an intent to get a message across, why not just give him the message? Why all this sort of drama around it?
Okay. Well, would you say that would apply to all cases where you have such it's such detail, or when we're questioning whether it's literal or not? Or are you seeing this specific drama here? There's something.
For me, it's the specific drama here. I mean, if the whole end point of this little subset of the larger story is, I didn't really want you to go, but now you can, just do what I tell you to do, this seems like an awfully elaborate and dramatic way to get that across. And if the errand was so troublesome to Hashem, then why go through all this in the first place? Why not just say, no, don't go? It seems odd to go through all this and say, well, I really didn't want you to go on this errand, but, okay, go ahead.
Well, you have in visions that there will be an angel speaking to a prophet and asking him questions. Do you understand what you're seeing? And there's a dialogue. I mean, there's the way in which God wants to impart knowledge is through engaging the human mind. So it gives it just enough information to that the person could use it. And there may be more details or less details depending on the case. But maybe when we see how it unfolds, we might see the particulars and why this was necessary.
And I could understand the need for a dialogue. This seems like a very convoluted way to have a dialogue. Through a donkey? I mean, why not just have the angel talk directly to Bilam?
Right. Okay. Keep in mind also that what's happening is that there is a conflict that he has, because where's the conflict? He God tells him in the beginning of the story that in the beginning of the vision, he says, who are these men that are with you? He engages Bilam in a dialogue, and he says that the king of Moab sent them to me, and he wants me to curse the Jews. So God says, no, you cannot curse the Jews, they are blessed. Nonetheless, Bilam tries after this to curse them. So we see that although God tells him not to, he still wants to. So he's in the conflict.
Right.
All right. You also had a case where you had the Jacob was wrestling with an angel. And as Rabbi Chait said, you see the beginning of that story, it says that V'yivaser Yaakov Levado, that Jacob was left alone after he crossed over the river. He was, you know, his brother was, he felt was coming to attack him with 400 men, and he was afraid, so he split up his camp into two, so at least one can get away. And while he was alone gathering his things on the other side of the river, it says that he wrestled the man there. So it already said that he was alone, so how could it be that he wrestled with a man? So clearly it's telling you, it's indicating just enough information for us. Again, God is trying to engage the Torah reader in using your mind to figure out what's going on. So we have to say that there was nobody there. That's what the verse says. So therefore, who was the man that was wrestling? It had to be a vision of some sort. And of course, here as well, I mean, we see that the donkey keeps on seeing the angel, but does Bilam see the angel? No, Bilam does not see the angel. So how could that be if it's a physical occurrence? So as long as you have eyes, you can see whatever is to be seen. You have two people standing in front of a door, and there's a sign on the door, and both of their eyes are open, and they both have healthy vision. Won't they both see the same thing? Of course. But if you're going to tell me that one person sees it, the other person doesn't, it indicates it's not an earthly phenomenon. Now, I'm going to also take license from Maimonides, who says that anytime you have a story in the Torah, and in the story, anywhere in the story, beginning or end, it mentions that there is an angel that either spoke or appeared, then you can know that the entire account is a vision. So Maimonides holds clearly here that this is a vision. This is not something which took place physically. So, but keep in mind, it's Maimonides says it's only when the angel spoke or appeared. But let's say, for example, it says that God took the angel of fire that was in front of the Jews as they were about to go into the Red Sea, and he moved it behind the Jews to separate between the Jews and the Egyptians. So there, it doesn't say that the angel appeared or that the angel spoke. It says that God took this angel and moved it. So there, that can be a physical occurrence, meaning an angel in that case would be the forces of nature. And King David says that the God makes the winds and the fires his ministers. So what does it mean that only when an angel spoke or appeared, that's when it must be a vision? What's the difference between God moving an angel or affecting the angel as opposed to if the angel spoke or appeared? See, when the angel speaks or appears, now it's showing will. It's showing that it has volition. So now, this is not something which, since an angel that has will, this is talking about something which is not taking place on earth. Because the only thing which has intelligence, and this is Maimonides' point, the only thing which has intelligence on earth is man, which completely debunks the theories of any type of spirits and so on and so forth. That's why the Torah says that these things are all forbidden, like Ibn Ezra says. That the Torah doesn't prohibit what is true, it prohibits what is false. Very, very valuable words of Ibn Ezra. So you see that Ibn Ezra, a very clear thinker, shows you clearly that the Torah is telling you that talking to the ghosts or warlocks or witches and all these practices and trying to consult the dead, if all these things are prohibited, it must be because they're false. There is no reality to them. There is nothing that has intelligence. There are no demons. So nothing has intelligence on earth except for man. So therefore, when it says that there was an angel that was speaking or it appeared, which indicates a will, intelligence, therefore that must be taking place in man's mind, not physically. But if it says that God moved an angel from in front of the Jews to the back of the Jews, there it's not saying the angel did anything. God did it. So that can be a different type of angel, which means it's a force of nature. An angel could be used to refer to intelligences which do not exist in the physical realm, but they can control the physical realm, of course, but they don't have a location. So you cannot say that the intelligence or an angel is on earth. It's in the conversation with man on the earth. No. It could be in dialogue, and like just like man can be involved in the spiritual realm, the intellectual realm, and the physical does not affect him at all in that case. So therefore, that dialogue, that's like this case with Bilam. Okay, so now that we taken license from Maimonides, and which I think is a very important step to understand this case, let's see if we can understand, you know, the actual account. And since it's now a vision, it can explain why Bilam doesn't see the angel, but the donkey does. And also, what's this thing about three times? It keeps on saying that it's three times that the donkey was turned aside. I think Rashi is the one that asks, what did the donkey see three times? So there's two things Rashi brings down. He says that the angel showed the donkey, on each one of the times, he showed him another one of the patriarchs, since the three patriarchs. So he first showed him an image or a reference to Abraham the first time, the second time to Isaac, the second time to Jacob. He also says that the angel showed him the three festivals. So it seems very, well, what do we care? And why does the donkey see it again and Bilam doesn't? Another question, what do I care that Bilam's leg got crushed the second time? It was a little bit more narrow. Each time it became more narrow and more inescapable. It was less and less avoidable as this whole traveling took place. What can we learn from that? And again, what is this crushing of the leg? And very, very significant is the fact that when Jacob wrestled with the angel, didn't he also hurt his leg? You recall that, right?
Yes.
Right. Is that just a coincidence? I don't think so. I think there's something very significant there.
Rabbi, the idea that comes to my mind is the opportunity for repentance here, and that when people choose to turn away from that opportunity, the consequences end up getting more severe, and that this was an opportunity for him to repent, and if you don't get it, you know, it becomes more severe.
What becomes more severe?
The consequence of turning away from that opportunity to see reality.
So you're correlating the fact that it became more narrow and narrow and more unavoidable with severity of punishment?
Yes, and then the fact that the donkey had said to him, "Have I ever disobeyed you before?" And that's when he really got it. You know, he said, "No, you haven't." And then, then he sees the angel too and realizes that there was a reason.
Yeah, isn't it startling that Bilam just talks back to the donkey as if it's another person talking to him? Isn't it? I mean, that seems to be also an indicator that this is not a natural event. Because if it was, you would not be able to talk back if your animal starts talking to you.
Yeah.
You would be completely taken back.
You know what strikes me, though, you talk about this as a vision, and I kind of, maybe it's inappropriate, but I link this to sometimes when you're having dreams, and in the dreams things seem really logical. But then when you go to kind of work through them afterwards, then you realize how bizarre they can be at times.
Right, but you weren't startled at something in the dream, right? So you're right. That's a good correlation. And what about the fact that it says that the third time, then it says he hit it with a stick? I mean, you see, the Torah is written so carefully that is really where, like Rabbi Chait would say, and he had said, that let the verses talk to you. I remember that so clearly resonating in my mind, that just let the verses talk to you, meaning God wrote these verses. Of course, he communicated them to Moses, and Moses wrote them, but this is where you get the tremendous wisdom from. So sometimes you'll hear somebody speak, and they're just going on with a concept. They're not showing you how it's worked out from the words. They're not showing you how to really excel you know, your thinking by giving you examples of how the verse has something which is out of place and how to figure out what that misplaced or seemingly misplaced or redundancy is really trying to point to. See, you have to be sensitive to that because that's really where the knowledge comes from. So by looking at this and being very sensitive to what's the, that's where you'll get more questions and more answers. So that's how God formulated the whole Torah. Just to write down all the facts, you would run out of ink. It's impossible to write down just every single point that God wants to have. Just getting back to your point, Doug. So the way you give an infinite system of knowledge to man is you have a limited amount of text, but it's written in a way that every single verse is opening up new vaults of wisdom. If you're sensitive to, this is out of place here. So when we see that, it gives us this thing three times. What is that? And the rabbis come in and they comment on that. And they say, oh yeah, the three things that the donkey saw that turned it aside was the three patriarchs or the three holidays, tabernacles and Passover and Shavuos. But what does that mean? And then when he hits it with a stick the last time, and then it gets more and more of a narrow way that the donkey can't avoid, eventually it can't even avoid that angel of God. These are all clues. These are all very generous clues in this story to try to start opening up what is going on over here. So if you think about it, you have three elements in the story. You have, actually, I would say three players. Who are the three players in the story?
You got Balaam and the donkey and the angel.
Exactly. And the donkey sees something and Balaam doesn't. Also, the relationship between Balaam and the donkey, that Balaam is riding the donkey, which may have just been understood. And the angel has a sword outstretched. Okay.
Rabbi, can I ask an aside? In my copy, the translation says she-donkey. And I'm wondering in the Hebrew if that's significant, or is there no difference between a she-donkey and a he-donkey in terms of the Hebrew word?
I didn't see any comments on that.
Okay.
So I'll leave that as an aside for now, like you said.
Okay.
And again, the leg being crushed against the wall, too. Like, what is going on there? So.
Then you also brought up the two young men who I don't recall we ever hear from again, except they're mentioned in verse 22.
Exactly. What is that? What does it mean that his two lads are with him? I think that's a very significant thing. Now, let's talk a little bit about, you know, conflict in general. So when a person's in conflict, you have a number of things that are going on in a person. And if anybody knows, you know, Freudian psychology, so you'll understand that, you know, a person is really, he has a number of components, but they're, you know, psychologically. But there's primary components. He basically has, as Freud would call them, the id, the ego, and the superego. So the ego basically means the person himself, his sense of self. Who am I? When I talk about the me, the I. The id is basically the instinctual drives. What he really, just all the compelling forces to have physical, emotional gratification. That's the id. And the superego is the sense of morality, the right and wrong that a person has. And again, in different cultures, different things will be considered right and wrong. But that's something which is partially sensed and partially due to nurture. But those are the primary elements that always come to play in a person's life, in his waking life. The truth is, even when he's sleeping, it's just that the conscious, the ego is is much distorted at that point. Now, what can happen is that a person will want something. He'll want something tremendously. So what happens in that case? When he just wants something so much, it's sort of like tunnel vision. And there's nothing else. And they, you know, a person can make mistakes in life, and we do. When this, it's a, you know, desire blinds you, they say. And you're going after something, and you just don't examine it fully as if something which is more objective and something which is neutral and has no emotional pull on you, you can be very clear in your thinking. But when there's a great desire there, many times we rush to it, and because of that, you know, haste makes waste, and we overlook things just because we're trying to get that thing, whatever it is, an object, an image of ourselves, whatever that desire is. And we don't really weigh out and see, you know, what the reality is. I think that's exactly what's going on over here with the whole story. Bilaam is great desire. He wants to curse the Jews for whatever reason. And he's in conflict, though, because God tells him that the Jews are blessed. So this is how I would play out the story. He, in this vision, is representing his id, his instinctual drive. That's why he's sitting on the donkey. The donkey is the thing which sees the angel of God. Angel of God, of course, is what the truth is, meaning the real superego. What is the right thing that you should be doing in this case? So what is it in the human psyche that sees the truth? That's really the conscious, meaning the superego. The donkey is really the superego. It's seeing the reality. Okay? So Bilaam is really representing the id. He just wants to push forward and keep hitting that donkey on the way to go curse. That's the desire. But is now the conflict is coming. What's causing him to turn aside? It's that donkey. It's that his superego. His superego is the part of the person that sees what is true and what's false. The emotions, the desires don't see that. That's not part of their design. Just like the heart pumps blood, it cannot breathe. That's not the apparatus. It doesn't have the ability to do that. And similarly, the lungs cannot pump. They just don't have that muscle to do it. So that's the same way the id. The drives of man nothing registers, nothing on the drives that stop it from going ahead. That's why Adam was able to sin right away, even though God told him not to eat. The design of just the instincts themselves, nothing held them back. They can overpower the sense of reality, the intelligence. So that's why the donkey alone sees the angel of God. The donkey recognizes the reality. That's the real unconscious of man. The superego, the sense of morality that we have. That's what really was trying to communicate to Bilaam. But he was so gung-ho and wanted to curse the Jews, he was blinded to that reality. That's what it means that he couldn't see the angel of God. The angel of God had a sword stretched out, a clear picture. He couldn't even see that. He was blinded because his desire was so strong, it wouldn't let him see it. So what was the element that he should have seen? See, he wants to curse the Jews. But the Jews had God's favoritism because of the patriarchs. Those three. That's what it means that the angel was showing the donkey three things. It was trying to show that you're trying to, really, Bilaam, you're trying to curse people, that the opposite is true. It's due to the forefathers that there is this favoritism that God has to them. So Bilaam was denying that. He was trying to suppress. That's what hitting the donkey is. And that's why, as he continued, it became more and more difficult because it was pushing forward. The information was pushing forward. Until finally, when the donkey spoke, so then, Ibn Ezra says that you see that the donkey died at that point. What does it mean the donkey died? It means that once the superego can push forward the information to your conscious, and you can now realize the reality, now the superego has done its job. It's not needed anymore. So saying that the donkey is dead means that the superego did his job. It now revealed the information to you, and now there's nothing left. There's no more task for it to do. So it leaves the stage. That's what it means that the donkey died. So that at that point, the reality hit Bilam, and then God still had to open his eyes to make him see it, though. He was still in tremendous conflict. That's also what it means about the three holidays. These three holidays is where the relationship exists. It's providence. That's what the holidays represent. There was providence in those three cases. That's why we make a holiday out of it. Now, what about the leg being crushed? See, the leg being crushed, as Rabbi Shade explained, when Jacob was wrestling with the angel, it means he was wrestling with a certain image of himself. And it happened at this specific time because now his brother, Esav, who was just a warrior, and all Esav was just an image. He was just, like a movie star. The whole essence of the person is just the image that he wants to project about himself. There's no real substance. But that, when Jacob came close with his brother, he now reflected a bit and saw he had a tinge of that too, because we're all human. So he saw that element of his personality, and he saw it as being damaging, and he worked on himself that night. That's what it means he wrestled with a man. It doesn't say he wrestled with an angel, it says he wrestled with a man. Because man means the image that a person has of himself. Ego. And Jacob saw at that point, my brother's like that, but I see I have a bit of that in myself too. So when his brother was approaching him, so that woke up in Jacob the realization that he had a tinge of that also. So he wrestled with it, and he overcame it. But when you overcome something in your nature and you redirect your energies to a new path in life, it's a slow process. That's represented by limping. So it doesn't mean he physically hurt his leg. It means that the conquest that he now, he was victorious in this conquest here, that it caused a redirection of his energies to a new, a higher level of existence. But it's a slow process. When people make a change from being non-observant to observant, if they're really genuine, it takes time. It's because you're withdrawing energies from one area, and then you have to redirect them. So it's not an immediate thing. That's fanaticism. So that's what it means that the donkey crushed his leg. That as he was in great, great conflict, here, the crushing of the leg doesn't mean that he perfected himself. It means that his energies were slowing down because the reality was about to surface. It's a different type, but it's talking about the same thing, because a leg means that which you could use to go in a certain path. That's what legs are for going in a certain path, walking in a certain path. But now he was slowing down his direction because it was starting to come to the foreground. And that's when the donkey spoke, and it finally gave him information. So we see that this whole story is now trying to give us all the different elements. And that's why it says in the beginning of the story there's two lads are with him. Meaning there was Bilam, but then there were two things with him. There was the sense of reality, what's the right thing, and the conscious that he was trying to repress, though. So which one was going to win? Was he going to stay on that donkey and repress the truth? Or was the angel going to, I mean, his sense of reality, was that going to actually give him the information? So it indicates right in the beginning that there's two things that he's taken with him. There's a conflict going on. And again, when a person is in conflict, when it finally, it doesn't last for too long. Something has to be done. Either the person could completely deny it, or, in this case, it came to the foreground and became less and less avoidable. That's what it means. It became more narrow and narrow path that the donkey couldn't turn aside anymore. There was no way that it could just not communicate to Bilam. At a certain point, it had to communicate to Bilam what was going on. Okay. Let me pause here. That's pretty much my analysis on this. And I think it's very interesting. I mean, that the Torah went out of its way to give us this insight. But you see, it's necessary for us to understand how the human workings are. But this is a story of conflict. And it would make sense that this is actually showing what the actual workings are. you know, there was one time when Freud wanted to give a lecture, and before he started, he told the audience that he knows that there's going to be a lot of opposition to what he's going to say, because it's not like he is, you know, a physician where he could show the body parts and explain how they work, because the psyche is completely abstract, and it's something which is hard to, for the mind to latch onto. So here, God uses these elements in order to give us something concrete to latch onto. But then he also gives us the indications that this can't be real. You don't just talk back to your donkey over here. It doesn't work that way. If there's two beings, and there's an angel of God there, how come only one being sees it and the other one doesn't? Therefore, it can't be a physical occurrence. Okay, let me pause over here, see if there's any questions or comments.
Rabbi, you talked about the donkey dying. I was a little confused by that, because we don't see in the story that the donkey dies. Is it just a threat of death that you're referring to?
No, it does say that. It says that, look at 22:33.
Right.
You read the verse.
The donkey saw me and turned away from me these three times. Had it not turned away from me, I would now even have killed you and let it live.
Let it live. That means it must be dead. Had it not turned aside, so that means it didn't give an opportunity for you, Bilam, but it did. It was doing you something. It did something good for you. Had it not turned aside, so then I would have reversed the case. You I would have killed, and the donkey I would have let live. But that's not the case. The case is where it did turn aside. So the angel is speaking to Bilam and saying, had something else happened over here, had that donkey turned aside, I would have let it live. So you see, the story does say that it died.
Okay, so the donkey is representing reality.
It's representing his superego.
Superego.
Right.
Or it is, it sees reality.
Yeah. And he is representing the emotions, his id, his instinctual drives. Instinctual drives don't have the ability to perceive. All they have the ability to do is to push forward the gratification, a seeking of gratification. That's all they have the ability to do. It's like your finger has no ability to perceive vision, to perceive light. That's just not part of the design. It doesn't have a capacity. And any of these substances or workings of the human finger don't have that ability. So too, the instincts of man have no ability to perceive what's right or wrong.
Hello?
Yes?
What about when he's going on a mission and he knows he can't curse them? So how it drives... he can't fulfill what he wants to do, knowing that. He says, I can't disobey Hashem.
Right.
So, his drive is to go do what at this point?
His drive was still trying to curse the Jews, but he had to cover himself whenever he came back and prophetically said blessings for the Jews. He was just pure ego. He had a... You know, Balak says, what are you doing? I brought you here to curse them, and now you're blessing them? So Bilam had to defend himself. I told you, I can't go against the word of my God. He made himself look out to be good. But he tries again. The fact that he keeps on trying shows that he's corrupt, but he has to keep on defending himself. He doesn't want to look like he does anything that he's doing wrong. But again, this is after the whole conflict.
So, Rabbi, I'm confused about then the passage, the interpretation of 32 and 33. I mean, I understand he's representing his ego, the id, that force that wants to drive through to his goal to curse the Jews.
Right.
And the angel represents reality. And remind me again, the donkey is representing...
the superego, the conscience.
The part of Balaam that can see reality.
Yeah.
So then the angel turns around and kills that, but lets the id survive?
Well, it doesn't say that it killed it. It says that I would have let it live. So something happened that it just stopped functioning. And I'm suggesting that it didn't die because it's a vision, right? It means that it stopped functioning. But it's hinted to by the fact that it's saying I would have let it live.
Okay, so can you explain that one in the context of those three roles? Not the people, but the id and the reality and so forth. Because that one's not making sense to me.
Okay. Well, the point that I'm making is that the superego, the consciousness of a person, only pushes forward until a person finally wakes up and sees he's doing something wrong. Once he sees he's doing something wrong, now he's got the information to work with to make a decision. So the conscious is no longer needed. It brought the information from the unconscious to the conscious. So now it's as if it's dead. That's another way of saying that it's not functioning anymore. It did its job. It brought the information forward. Now you as the person have to decide, what am I going to do? Am I going to keep on functioning as I was? Or will, and just, you know, forget the reality and then make my decision? Or will I listen to it? Will I heed the words and do the right thing? But either way, now that the information is brought to my conscious mind, so now my sense of morality, that donkey, that conscience, my conscience that was pushing forward all the time and I was just suppressing it, I wasn't facing it, now that it gives me the information, now I have to do something with the information. But there's no need for the conscious anymore. So that's all I'm trying to say is, what does it mean that it died?
Okay. So if he hadn't turned away, then he would have gone, speaking sort of metaphorically, or he would have gone straight into the truth. So his ego would have died, which was the kill you part, but the superego that sees reality would have lived.
Right. I mean, the reverse would have taken place. You're right. That the instinctual drives would have been gone. Because he conquered them. If he turned aside, if he really listened, you know, from the outset, if he listened to his morality, his conscience, then the reverse would be true. That means, you see, that would still be guiding him. He makes a decision based on his conscience, as if the conscience is still alive. And the conscience is now keeping him on the right track, and now the instincts are dead because he won over them. But the reverse happened here. He stuck with the instincts, and now the conscious, even though it came to the foreground, he didn't follow it.
Okay.
So whichever one wins out, that's the one that stays around, which is different than what I'm saying, but I actually like what you're saying better. I was saying that the conscious, once it gives us information, it dies. But the truth is, this is now saying otherwise. It's saying that the conscious would have continued to live had you heeded it. Which implies that when you heed either your sense of justice or your sense of just desires, whichever one you heed, the other one falls out of the picture as if it's dying. So had he listened to the sense of his conscious, then, like the angel is saying, that would have stayed around, the conscious. And you would I have killed, meaning your instincts would have been put under control, as if they died.
So it's kind of like whichever one you follow, you're going to strengthen that one.
Yeah.
By the sheer act of following it.
That's right. That's what the saying of the rabbi is, that one mitzvah causes another one. And the opposite is also true. One sin causes another one. Which means that the more a person trains himself in a certain path, the stronger he gets in that path. It says by Abraham also, that God says to him, walk before me and be complete. So the rabbis say on that a very interesting and enigmatic statement. They say, that which is complete is very complete. Which sounds to me to mean that when a person is living at 95% of his capacity to really be a righteous person, he's still having a certain outlet of 5%. But if he keeps it, and now he's 100% righteous, so now he didn't just go up 5% more. It's not a quantitative thing. There's a whole new quality that when a person is now 100% pure, that gives him an additional strength that he's additionally fortified. So he's not just complete, you know, quantitatively, that he's doing all the things he's supposed to be doing, but now that living in that path, it bolsters him even more to defend off any type of acts of succumbing to sin. There's an additional strength there. Maybe it's because now that he has that and he's completely in control, so to break it is even more of a difficulty for that person. So you can imagine a person is dieting but cheats a little bit here and there. So the diet is not so strong, even though they're dieting 99% of the time. But if they diet 100% according to what they're doing, it's like, you know, same thing with cold turkey. It's easier to go cold turkey and stop smoking than to, you know, just cut down. Because down is an outlet. You're still leaving a conduit of an outlet for the desires. You don't have that additional strength. When you do something complete and you go cold turkey, there's an additional, that's just sort of designed the way it is, that there's an additional strength there. I'm not sure why that is, to tell you the truth. But I sense that it is there. So God says to Abraham, walk before me and be complete. And the rabbis say that which is complete is very complete. It means to say that when you get to a point where you're doing everything you're supposed to do, now that has an additional strength in the psychology. I think maybe also because when you put your full energies into something, like the Shema says, that you should love your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. What do you mean all? Meaning when you have, you're completely immersed in it, that's a whole different level of person. Now all of his energy is in it, and the benefits that he gets when he's completely immersed in the right life, that's tremendous. It's always on his mind. He never leaves it. We never did this before, Doug.
Well, I think we may have talked about this story before, but to the best of my knowledge, we've never done it with this approach.
Uh-huh. Okay. I wasn't sure. It's just such an impressive thing, you know. We have so many elements. Yeah, that's why it says at the end of the story that the third time he uses a stick to hit the donkey. Why does it have to tell us that? Because as the conscious is trying to push forward, if you're the type of person that wants to suppress the truth, you have to use more and more force as the battle continues. Because it's getting stronger and stronger. The ability to deny becomes less and less. So you need a bigger object to suppress it. And crushing the leg. I mean, it's just beautiful. These subtle hints are in there. And the three times, it really makes that, you know, clear, because we have four times, it brings up the words, Shalosh Ragolim, these three times, the donkey turns aside. Three is very, very integral to the story, because that's really where the whole conflict came from. Because that's where the commencement of God's relationship with the Jews was, because of the patriarchs. So that's what Bilam knew, deep in his mind, deep in his heart, he knew that's really where that started. It's not so much that the relationship was there, but where did it start from? That's what really was clear in his mind, but he had to deny that. What earned the Jews this type of relationship? Oh, I know where it started. It was Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So that's why, that's what was really bothering his conscience.
So, is the three only referring to that, or is it also referring to the three players in the story?
No, just to the patriarchs, or to the three holidays. That's just a coincidence that there's three by both.
And when you say the three holidays...
It's Passover, Tabernacles, and Shavuos. Because that represents the cases where there's the providence for the nation. So that providence of a nation equally bothered Bilam, because he's trying to curse these people, but he can only curse the people with God. He can't do it himself. That's why he keeps on saying this God. You know, come, you know, curse me, the people. He knows it's not in his hands. So it's a tremendous conflict. This God that created the universe favors his people, and I now want him to go against what he favors? What a tremendous conflict this was. It's just amazing how you know, we're fortunate. We really have to be fortunate that we've come to see the truth and what we value in life. And you look at people like this that can be completely blinded. I mean, that's really what this whole vision is telling you. Look how blind this person was. He had intelligence and just he missed it. He completely missed reality.
Rabbi?
Yes, Cal.
I think the question that I've always had about this story is why would God choose someone like Balaam to represent the prophet for the Gentiles?
Well, the Rashi, I believe, or one of the commentators says that you don't typically see a prophecy with the other nations. But it was in order to close the mouths of those people who would say that had we had prophets, we'd be as good as the Jews. So God shows you, no, you can have prophecy and completely be corrupt. It's not prophecy that is what gains you God's favor. It's your own perfection, using your intelligence and choosing the right. Just because you have prophecy doesn't mean that it changes you internally. There was even a story somebody told me recently. Not a story, it's concerning a story with King David and Nathan, the prophet. And when King David initially wanted to create the temple, so Nathan said to him, do what is in your heart to do. But ended up the God said to David not to make it. So somebody was quoting Rabbi Chait, who was making a point, that you see that even though Nathan was a prophet, it doesn't mean that he always was correct. So prophecy doesn't guarantee that you have the right ideas, and certainly that you're going to be a perfected person. Even without prophecy, look at Abraham. He raised himself from the depths, you know, the abyss of idolatry to the heights of human perfection, completely independent of any other influence, just his mind. So it's the mind that really creates the perfection in the person.
So if all Balaam did was to look at the laws of nature like a meteorologist, then did he really have prophecy? I mean, granted, in this particular circumstance, God intervenes directly, but if all he's doing is basically just looking at laws of nature, can it be argued that he really was a prophet?
Well, it says that God put the words in his mouth, and that God spoke to him, but it talks about it in a, you know, backhand type of way. It says, V'yikar. It was like, you know, not such an intense prophecy. Or even when God appeared to Laban when he was chasing after Jacob to kill him. So God came to him in the visions of the night and told him. So God could communicate with man. It's not no limitation. But it's not the height of prophecy, because you see that the way it talks about it is V'yikar, which means like, what's the verse? Where is it? Yeah, it's 23:4. Like an occurrence. And Rashi even says, it was like, you know, a very temporal type of a communication, and it's a language of degradation. Also he says it's referring to a forced type of it had to happen. It wasn't really out of the perfection of Bilam that he received the prophecy. Also, when Paro stole Abraham's wife, God spoke to him in a dream. Not because of his perfection, that's for sure. So you see, you can have the prophecy without being a perfected individual.
I see.
I mean, maybe for the sake of Abraham and Sarah, he communicated to Paro in the dreams.
That makes sense. Rabbi?
Yes, yes, Josh.
In the beginning of the story here, it's talking about when the officers came to Balaam, and he says to them, stay here for the night and, see what Hashem is going to tell me. It seems like, and this is almost like stuff, that Moses said, wait here and I'll see what Hashem says. Did Balaam actually have the, could he receive prophecy whenever he wanted to, like that, or was he just kind of bluffing in this case?
Yeah, he was... He had no knowledge that God was speaking to him at this point.
Was he just saying that to them, and then it just happened to actually...
Yeah, it's a good point. I'll have to look into that, but I would say that there was no, conviction that he had. It could have just been he was bluffing. And if God doesn't come to him, if God doesn't come to him in the vision, so then he'll cover himself and he'll say, let me try again tomorrow night or something.
You really know whether he had a vision or not, right? You could claim he did, even if he didn't.
Right, that's true. But he could not have prophecy whenever he wanted. It's one of the big distinctions of Moses and all the other prophets.
It seems like there's at least claiming.
Let me just see if anybody... It's a good question. Let me see if anybody mentions that. Let's see if anybody asked that question. Don't see. Well, it's a good observation though, Josh. But there's no way that he can be sure. I mean, you can't know God's will. That's why it's so important if we have the fundamentals, then even questions like this we'll know how to answer, even if we don't have any commentators telling us the facts. I don't see Rashi mentioning something in this. Let me see. Yeah, I don't see anything on that. Good question, though. I would say that for sure he didn't know. You see how the Torah goes out of the way to inform us of how a person works. Okay. All right, any other questions or comments?
good here.
I'm still having kind of a hard time with the whole idea of, I'm trying to remember where I read this, but something of Maimonides, where he was talking about, it seemed like he was saying a person would have to be a very perfected person to receive prophecy, or be on a really high level and be like a righteous person. All that type of thing. Then I know, like you pointed out, there's times when I think like even Taro seemed to receive prophecy.
And Laban as well.
Right. Yeah. I assume.
But again, the rabbis do say it was at night, so it's a very low form, and it wasn't because of their perfection. It could be Maimonides was talking about in the perfected state, what does a person have to do in order to receive prophecy? I mean, the prophecy that they're getting in terms of their own perfection. Here, these prophecies were all in terms of corruptions, trying to halt a certain corruption, stopping Balaam from cursing the Jews, and not that they would do anything, and stopping Laban from killing Jacob, and stopping Paro from taking Abraham's wife.
Mm-hmm. But in those cases, those people wouldn't necessarily be even like in the category of prophets, really.
That's right.
They're just,
they could be really corrupt.
Yeah.
That's right. All right. All right, so I guess we'll wrap it up here. And I'll have to be in touch with you regarding next week. So let's just, Doug, let's be in touch before we send out the email. Yeah, let's touch base on Wednesday, all right?
Okay.
Okay, very good.
That sounds good.
All right, everybody. So everybody have a good week.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rabbi.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
Rabbi. Be well.
Be well, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.